When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Guess what? It's time to hear about comic books again. So, it's summer, and as you've noticed, Sharon and I have slowed things down a bit as we stay busy with our day jobs, as well as rest and recuperate and make plans for what we're going to be doing with Modern Minorities in the months to come. But by now, you know about my other podcast, Quarantine Comics, with friend of the pod, Ryan Joe. From time to time, some of the stories Ryan and I read reveal a minority truth for all of our majority ears, so it feels appropriate to share here on Modern Minorities. So I wanted to share our recent conversation about the graphic novel In Limbo, the debut graphic memoir by Deb J.J. Lee. This autobiographical tale of a young Korean-American teenager is a beautiful coming-of-age story covering mental health and gender identity. For so many of us who have often felt like outsiders, this story is painfully familiar and brings forth a lot of empathy for those around us who are invisibly struggling. We can't recommend this book enough. So hear this Quarantine Comics chat and be sure to pick up a copy of In Limbo, wherever you get your favorite books.
Hey, don't write yourself off yet. It's only in your head you feel left out or looked down on. Try your best, try everything you can. It doesn't matter what they tell themselves when you're away. It just takes some time. Little girl, you're in the middle of the ride. Everything will be just fine. Everything will be alright, alright.
Ryan, have you ever wondered what it's like being an Asian teenage artist coming of age in the suburbs of a big city with an unpredictable and often unbearable mother, while also saddled with a sense of regret and ennui?
That sounds familiar.
Because this is a story about your lived experience?
I'm actually on good terms with my mom, Ruman, I will have you know. But no, actually, I was referring to the fact that we've been reading a lot of stories about troubled teenage girls.
Technically, Carrie was in her 20s, but as a father, I'm just trying to prep myself.
Well, there's always boarding school. You can make her somebody else's problem.
I went to a boarding school, for your information.
Oh, good. So there's precedent.
I'm Roman Segel.
And I'm Ryan Joe.
And we are two dudes who just love reliving our hormonal teenaged angst.
And all of that anguish, tearful music.
Everybody hurts sometimes. This week we're reading In Limbo, the debut graphic memoir by Deb J.J. Lee. Our story introduces us to Deb, a young Korean-American teenager trapped in an inescapable feeling of otherness. For a while, their English wasn't perfect. Their teachers can't pronounce their Korean name. Their face and their eyes, especially their eyes, feel wrong. Things only get harder once high school starts, shifting sands of arts and academics, escalating tensions at home, friendships made and frayed, and mental health struggles that are all too real to anyone who's ever felt like an outsider. With stunning art and a tale that feels like you're slipping in and out of an all too familiar dream, this is a story that you cannot leave easily. So Ryan, how much emotional baggage did this book stir up for you?
I actually had a lot of anxiety reading, especially the opening pages of the story. Like, I would say, like, Deb's high school experience was way more, I wouldn't say traumatic, because it's not like something like crazy and huge happens, but it was just a lot more fraught than mine was. And I think the thing that Deb experienced and that they are so good at capturing is the fact that there's no real safe place for Deb to go, not except for orchestra, but of course in the very beginning they quit, but wherever they go they are reminded of how they don't belong because they are Asian and nobody else really is. At home they have this really tense relationship with their mom, And even when they go to a Korean school, all of the Korean students are incredibly mean to her. Even their name, right? No one can pronounce it in their white person school. And of course, in
American school,
in their Korean school, everybody just makes fun of it because it's the name of an old man.
Well, I mean, there's a moment, it's like a two-panel spread where they show their experience at Korean school where they're perceived as too American, right, and their experience at, like, quote-unquote American school where they're too Korean or too Asian. And it's like, you can't win. And I mean, that was one of those moments that just really, as someone who doesn't fit in with the Indian crowd, yeah, it just, like, really hit home. Like, you can't fucking win. You can't win. Where do you, there's no sense of belonging. And it's really just isolating.
That was actually really interesting to me also, because Deb spent their first 3 years in Korea. And the fact that even being a Korean-born Korean-American, they feel too American around everybody else. But the other thing I think that Deb really makes a point of is that they really, especially in high school, have no conception of the troubles of what other people are going through. You know, this is like every high schooler. You're caught in your own head. All of your troubles are the only troubles, and they're magnified to the nth degree. And Deb, in their memoirs, is very honest with that. And it's only towards the end where Deb starts to realize that some of her other friends and classmates who they thought might have abandoned them actually were going through their own shit. That was probably just as bad as what Deb was going through, and Deb just wasn't aware of it because Deb was just caught up in their own head, which is sort of typical of teenagers. So, like, to the point of Deb feeling not really in touch with their Korean self either, one wonders, even in Korean school, if other people were feeling the same way, and Deb just wasn't aware of that.
You know, what's another really interesting thing, when I read the front and the back of the book, and, like, the names who were, like, heaping praise on this book are just immense. But I was like, okay, this is a queer coming of age memoir. We've been making a real effort to not misgender the character Deb, the author Deb, as we've been reading it. But honestly, like, I didn't even read that much into queer identity as I was reading the book. I'm sure it's there, and I probably, if upon a rereading, I would catch it. But I found more of it to be about, like, Asian immigrant sense of belonging. And I hate to say, like, the typical teenage shit that we all feel. That's where my angst and anxiety came from as I was reading this book.
Yeah.
And then to recognize that some of that might have been born from that, like, gave me even more empathy for, fuck, it must be, like, even harder. Like, when you are having, I don't know, man. It's just...
Well, Deb's gender identity isn't really dealt with in Limbo. And whether that's just a part of their life that they decided not to dramatize, or if that's not something that even registered until they were perhaps older, which would have encompassed a period after Limbo.
But knowing that, like, did you read into any of that inside of the relationships that Deb had in the book? Like, the best friend that they fall out with, etc.?
No, I didn't. I mean... Deb's depression is just, it's like a milieu of things, right? Mm-hmm. It's racial. Perhaps it's based off of their uncertainties around their gender. It's this feeling of not fitting in. There's the familial aspect. There's just a whole bunch of different stuff. And whether, I didn't read, like, any one specific thing. And it was, and actually that's one of the things I admired about this book. It's never one thing that's really upsetting to Deb. It's just a whole bunch of things, and it's a whole bunch of things that oftentimes I don't think Deb really knows how to articulate. And that gets oftentimes very misconstrued, right? When Deb tries to commit suicide, Quinn thinks that Deb did it because of her. And that's the basis of Quinn cutting Deb off. It's sort of a miscommunication around it. There's a whole bunch of other things that's happening in Deb's head that leads her to that moment where she tries to OD on Tylenol, of all things. But it's stuff that I think isn't, it doesn't have, like, an easy, oh, it all leads back to this one thing. It all leads back to racial identity. It all leads back to problems with mom. It's all just thrown into this sort of boiling melting pot. And and it just manifests in this habit of self-destruction.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the mom. In the intro, you mentioned having a great relationship with your... And honestly, I think I had a pretty good relationship with my parents, and I can't say that was the same for a lot of my friends of children of immigrants growing up. Like, I have one of my very close friends was like, your family seems so normal by comparison, is kind of what I've been told. And I'm grateful for that. I'm happy to have had that experience. But were there other things that, like, honestly, like, it's so superficial, but it's like, I played the violin. I'm definitely not.
I played the violin level. Too.
Yeah.
When did you start? When did they focus on art? Wait, when did they make you start?
I only did it in fifth and sixth grade. My parents let me.
Okay.
Violin and art in after school lessons because I had an aptitude for music and visual arts. And I quit violin and I went all in on the visual arts all through high school. Still a closet creative, wish list things I wish I could spend more time on. But it was like what's interesting is the mom in Limbo, Dev's mom, is like significantly more supportive about the quitting and the rejoining. And I thought that was really interesting.
So it's an interest. So initially, it's sort of like the mom seems to very shrill, tiger mom sort. And then, you know, there's this moment where that surprises you when Deb says, I'm quitting violin. The mom is, of course, pissed about that. And then she like enrolls Deb into this New York City art school and says, hey, it's my job to make you happy. And it's like, oh, okay, it's another dimension to mom. But then the mom goes back to being really, at times, just really, really harsh on Deb.
Mercurial. And, she's mercurial.
Right. But also there's this point later on where Deb gets sick of it. Right, where the mom says, hey, it's my job to make sure that you're happy towards the end. And Deb turns their back. And it's sort of like this sign where she's just tired of this pattern of, well, they articulate it also. Sometimes she's like the best mom of the year. And other times she's just really, really mean to her. And they're getting tired of that sort of cyclical pattern. And even in the Deb's afterwards on the mom comes down pretty harsh. I think Deb writes, my mom has acknowledged her wrongdoings and accepts the content of the book as it is and has sweetly requested that I quote make her look pretty end quote. So even Deb's afterwards, it's definitely like, mom, you are wrong. You were mean to me. But I do think that Deb does, at least in the actual comic, tries to be generous about the treatment of their mom despite having some very, very nasty dust ups. And I will say, have you ever told your mom to shut up, Roman?
I don't want to put that in recording ever.
I told my mom to shut up once when I was about Deb's age.
I've done it.
Oh, it did not whack. It did not go so well. So I mean that blow up that the mom has when Deb says shut up. I don't know if you're like, oh, yeah. I remember that scene, that panel, where Deb says, shut up. I'm like, and then all the drama happens the next page. But even before I flip the page, I'm like,
you know where this is going.
It is. You do not tell an Asian mom to shut up.
To shift gears a little bit, one thing that it's worth mentioning, in most comic books, when someone's speaking in another language, you do the brackets thing so you can understand they're translated from whatever language. You see that in comics, whether it's Italian or Skrull. And in this comic, they do a fair number of that for like extended conversations that are in Korean. But there's moments where what Deb does is she actually writes the word in Korean. And I think to signal she only half understands the Korean that her mom is speaking. And
oh, interesting. I was actually wondering about that. Yeah, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, because remember, Deb doesn't, she speaks, I'm going to misnumber this, they speak at almost like a elementary school level of Korean. And I kind of get that, like my Punjabi is probably, Punjabi and Hindi is like way worse than Deb's Korean, but it shows their lack of understanding sometimes. But at the same time, every time I read it, I was like, oh, is the mom cursing? Like, is something so terrible being said that it's in Korean? But it's not that. It's okay. So one reflection upon the mercurial nature of Deb's mom. Obviously, there's a lot of reflection on my own immigrant parents and probably your own immigrant parents. But again, we've talked about this a little bit on the pod. I'm reflective of my own mercurial nature with my kids. Like right now, I've been suffering from like a major headache and health issue for the last week. Everything's fine. But as a result, I've been really like testy around my children, especially my 7-year-old daughter. So much so that I had to apologize in the morning as I was dropping her off. And upon picking her up, I gave her fair warning. Hey, honey, I'm not feeling that good. I'm going to be a little short-tempered. You're probably best to like leave me alone and let me get dinner made, etc. And I think a lot about the mixed messages that my mercurial, grouchy nature sends to my children and what my daughter and son are going to remember me as. And reading Deb's interpretation, I'm like, maybe my daughter shouldn't go into the arts and draw a graphic novel about how I was in her youth.
What's nice is at least you give her a heads up. Deb's mom doesn't seem to give her a heads up. You fuck up the kitchen,
I think it's because I was thinking about this book. This morning I was thinking about this book and my reflections on this book.
But that's a good thing, right? Because now you're thinking about how Deb's mom came across. And
so if you're a parent, read this book.
Read this book to understand. In a way, though, like I appreciate In Limbo and also the Zoe Thorogood we read, It's Lonely at the Center of the Earth, because they're both really good at giving you a very clear picture about what's going on in the author's heads at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. Deb's book is a little bit probably about 10 years before, and Zoe's is a lot more recent, but mm-hmm. I feel they both just create a really clear picture of the internal complexity of these characters, of the authors, frankly, during some very troubled times in their lives. And it's actually really cool to see this illuminated, because it changed the way you interacted with your own daughter, Raman.
Yeah. Graphic memoirs, I don't want to say worry me, but like I feel like not even graphic, well, I mean, whether it's about deep personal experiences like Zoe Thorogood or Deb Lee, or even some of the like historical events we've read about, I think they hit and they resonate so much harder. To be clear, it's an artistic interpretation, but knowing that it's rooted in a truth and it's not a fiction makes the story punch a lot harder, especially in graphic memoirs. Because obviously with film, I think I've talked about this about the comics medium before. With film, you're cycling through it. You're moving through time with the director, with the actors. With prose, you're just reading and processing, internalizing in real time. You're moving through the pages. But with graphic novels, you can't help but pause and linger on moments. The moment that they told their mother to shut up. The moment that they didn't fit in. Like, it's like poetry in the sense that you can linger and you frames and sequences can just like sit with you, and you're literally, you take a screenshot in your head and you're left with it. That image burns in your brain a lot more in this medium. I think
it also feels also the two you mentioned, Lee and Thorogood, because they're memoirs, you get a real feel for how complex and contradictory their mentalities often are. There's a richness to it that you wouldn't get if they were trying to project themselves into the heads of somebody else. In a way, because both Zoe and Deb are so in touch with their own emotions and how they're feeling, and are so talented as artists in bringing that to the surface and showcasing that in a graphic form. So it's both their own observations and their own sensitivities in their observations, as well as, you know, their ability to communicate that in a graphic form that really gives it a sort of unique power, I think.
You're a writer, Ryan. Would you ever write a memoir?
No, I think my life is boring. You know? I have nothing to write about. Would you? I mean, what do you think? Would you? Would you ever want to do something like this?
I mean, I think there's a book I read recently called Storyworthy. I'd highly recommend it. It's by one of the Moth Grand Slam winners, if you listen to the Moth podcast or the Moth Radio Hour. And I've been going through this exercise of effectively light journaling every day to write a story and a segment from the day for the past few months. And there's some other exercises. It's an exercise of recollection that gets you to dredge up old stories. And some of the stuff we've been reading on this podcast, my other podcast, where I talk with a lot of guests about their youth, and it dredges up a lot of experiences. I guess what I'd say, Ryan, is I think it's easy to say we've all led fairly boring lives, and definitely some people have lived more interesting lives than we have. But I think everyone's life has an interesting story. You just have to kind of like dig for it, or we have to dig for it, either as someone interviewing the other person or literally reflecting and thinking upon the things that happened. Is there enough for a book? I don't know, because there's a talent to writing it as well.
I would say that my interiority is so tedious, I don't really want to spend too much time thinking about it. But I do feel like, I mean, like, you're stuck in your own head all the time. It is, to me, it's sort of boring, because how you think, I just don't feel like interested in unpacking it, which might, you could also say, is just sort of like a lack of introspection. So who knows?
Or a lack of willingness to introspect. What are you hiding, Ryan? What's behind there?
Yeah, that's true. It's all of the children I've killed. Oh, wait, we're recording.
Worth noting, it sounds like we both really enjoyed this book, which makes for a short, interesting episode. But and so getting into our own interiority is always fun. But like, the art is beautiful. I cannot, like, the cover, if it's like the abstract nature of the cover, like, I'm not sure what dream she's passing through on this cover, but like the monocolor, it's just so beautiful. Like, I picked this up, and it's the cover quote is by Tilly Walden, who's someone who I hope we read in this A to Z thing that we're doing right now. The first three pages are all, or the back cover and the first three pages are all quotes by like people I just genuinely admire, be it Sean Tan, Sarah Alfaghi, Malika Gharib, Arkiku Johnson, etc., etc. Just like, the cover blows you away, the quotes blow you away, and just flipping through this book, like, if you can walk to your library and just go flip through it, you can't not be drawn. And it's like a dreamlike state, similar to Carrie and even the Zoe Thorogood books, because it's this monocolor. There's clearly like really amazing inking and coloring that's going on, even though it's monocolor. Like,
yeah, I actually kind of wish I could see some of Deb's work in color, actually. I mean, because if you look at some of Deb's illustrations, including the one on the cover, it's actually like really, really vibrant. And I do like some of the black and white quality of what they're doing. It's actually very, very moody and really cool. But I do actually really like the vibrancy of their colored work. And I was like, oh, that'd be actually cool if we could see more of it, though that would obviously probably been a pain in the ass to do. I will say, yeah, after reading this graphic novel, try to find pictures of Deb and look at their eyelids.
And look at them. Well, let's talk about that.
Well, their eyelids. Yeah, they definitely, and yes, Deb has the eyelid.
Well, explain this, because double eyelids. I did not know this. I had to actually ask.
Double eyelids. Oh.
Well, okay. No. I know that most people have double eyelids, and we obviously all know that many East Asians don't have the
epicanthic fold. Yes.
And so we're all aware of that. What I was not aware of, and I had to ask my Chinese American wife while I was reading this, like, is this a thing?
Oh, yes. So does she have? We can cut this part. But does she have the folds?
No. My wife's not getting some form of surgery.
Okay. So some people, I have the folds, man. You've seen my face.
Here's the thing. I am face blind. I don't pay attention to this shit. But explain to our audience, one, the eyelid thing, but more importantly, the commonly accepted practice in Korean culture. Explain this.
It's not just Korean. It's like us other Asians also. But yes, Korean.
Really?
Sophie's staring at me now, blinking. That's
Sophie,
my wife.
Your Korean-American wife.
Yes.
No, your Korean-Korean wife.
Yes. But yeah.
Wife stares at you while you're doing your podcast? My wife like hides from me.
Well, she heard me being like epicanthic fold, and she like, just rushed out of the room. It's like, hey, she's like, check it out. So the epicanthic fold is sort of like, for all you white people out there who take it for granted, is sort of like that.
Black people too.
Black, Hispanic people.
Non-Asian.
So, well, some Asians have it. I have it. It sort of like gives you that double eyelid, which basically makes your eye look wider. If you look at a lot of East Asian eyes, they have like sort of like they don't have that double eyelid, that line.
It's a single fold in the eyelid.
It's a single fold. And that's not considered attractive. I'm not the one who said that. That's just sort of culturally, it's more attractive to have the double eyelid because it makes your eye look bigger. And so, especially in Korea, it's...
Some Asian standards. Because isn't it the other way around in terms of like Asian objectification? Like, people like the Asian eyes, right?
I mean, but I would say even if you have the epicanthic fold, you could still have the Asian eyes. Like, Sophie has it. And my entire family actually has it. And we still have, I would say, Asian eyes. Like, we still have... So our eyes are distinctly Asian. So it's... I think it's not like the epicanthic fold, like, makes you look automatically Caucasian, but it does give your eye...
Okay, so you've set this up and explained it. Now explain it in the context of the book.
Well, it's not just... the book, it's just culturally, people want that epicanthic fold. And so they will have surgery to get it, including Deb. And Korea.
I had never heard of this until I read this book.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Well,
I think most of our audience, who I would assume are not Asian, did not know this.
Yeah, well, in Korea, it's so I was talking to, I've actually talked to Sophie about this, and she had mentioned that it's not even considered surgery there. It's just, quote unquote, a procedure because it's so common. Like, you just kind of go.
Explain what the procedure is.
It's just the procedure is they just cut an extra fold into your eyelid. Deb JJ Lee explains it much better and graphically, but it's essentially, yeah, you just get an extra eyelid.
And this is like a major recurring theme of something she aspires to do, and their very close friend, who's American, but is really curious and wanting to learn about not just Korean language, but Korean culture.
Yeah, that actually really interesting.
How could you do this? How could you do this?
Quinn's reaction was interesting to me because, like, that's why I was talking to. I talked to Sophie about this last night. I was reading. It's not that big of a deal, right, Sophie? And Sophie was like, "No, it's like I said, everyone gets it. It's a procedure. No one gives a shit. It's just you do it, you go in, you get it, it's done." But I think in America, where Asian identity is something that distinguishes you, that eyelid surgery. Perhaps it feels a bit more loaded and consequential, especially through the point of view of a white girl who thinks of Deb as perhaps obliterating or trying to obliterate or trying to mask her Asian identity. But it's not really, I mean, like I said, like if in Korea, it's just a procedure. It's just so common. So it's just a different.
It's almost like it's this weird thing where non-immigrants are like, "You're so lucky. Why would you want to give it up?" And it's like this lack of acknowledgement.
Well, I don't think anyone says you're lucky to have a monolid, but that's
It's like, why would you want to give up your heritage when it's almost like it's sweet that you're saying it and trying to be an ally, but you clearly don't understand the need to fit in, we need to, because of all the other passive aggressive bullshit that goes on. Like, all it's of just our needs to want to fit. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a beauty standard that goes beyond just wanting to be white, I think. It's a beauty standard that exists in Asia. And like I said, it's not like Asians don't have the double eyelid. A lot of Asians have it. It's just considered desirable for whatever reason. But to that point, though, like Sophie, she would dye her hair a lot, and then in Korea, and then she came here and she didn't realize that, oh, actually having black hair is considered unique, or maybe if not unique, it's sort of a distinguishing feature. But of course, when you're in Asia, everyone has black hair, so people are just trying to dye it a different color to stand out. But here, that's
worth
not
noting,
as necessary.
So my son, too. Has not my daughter has thick hair like me, Indian. My son has wispier hair. Like it's not that it's thin. It's just not as thick as mine. So it's closer to my wife's hair. But for a while, as his hair was growing, we were like, "Wow, it's brown!" But oh, it must be brown because we can kind of see his head underneath. But my son's hair is brown, and I'm like, "Where is this coming from? This is very strange." Like to Asian people, and don't make the obvious mailman joke, but it's like literally. What is going on here? This is genuinely like really interesting that his hair is brown at the same
time. Like my brother had curly hair for a while. No one in my family had curly hair. And then one day my mom shaved it off because it was summer and it was hot. And it grew back straight. Hair's just freaking weird, man. It's the ongoing mystery that no one's motivated enough to try to solve.
So, Ryan, I got to ask my next to last question. Would you recommend In Limbo to someone to read?
Oh, yeah, I definitely recommend In Limbo. It's just it's a really honest story. It's one that I feel creates just this really interesting portrait of Deb during a particularly fraught time in their life. And the art is beautiful also. I think that Deb has a very unique aesthetic, and their art is not like... really, I think anyone who's working today. So yeah, absolutely. How would you? Would you? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think unequivocally, this is one of those rare episodes where we're all on the same page about how much we like this book for different reasons, but a lot of the same. But I think I'm going to put my other podcast, Modern Minorities, hat on and probably air this episode in that feed at some point. Like, this book is the perfect Modern Minorities read. If you want to understand not just the Korean American experience, and absolutely there were learnings for me, and even while there's not a lot of queer identity stuff in here, I think if you read between the lines, you can try to sense the feelings that she's having, even though it's not articulated of why. But I hate to say it, like, there's so many things that rang true for me as an Asian American growing up in this country. I think she even spent a few years growing up in the South. I think it was Alabama. And some of those things were like just...
So actually, I was actually wanted to ask you about Deb's experiences in Alabama and how it gelled with yours.
Oh, it's 1,000% accurate. It barely scratches the surface, but in those few panels, it's just an earned authenticity of what to expect. And some of that is because it's just like, and it's all humans. Like, things were, I'm just as ignorant about certain things, but I have the ability to try to catch myself on it, be it pronouns and misgendering. And I, at the same time, like, I just think it's not a monoculture anymore, for sure. The world is different than it was 40 years ago. But her experiences 20, 30 years ago were in the limited panels that they showed. And someone I want to reach out to have a conversation with on my other podcast, right? As with a lot of these authors that we've been, they had an authentic experience in Alabama that rang true to what mine was, I guess, is the short answer.
But you also got to ask me another question, Ryman.
Oh, well, Ryan. I mean, okay, we've read some really heavy shit for these last three.
Yeah, we're gonna take it. So, we're gonna be really nice.
Please tell me, Ryan.
Well,
bring it up a notch.
Next week, we're gonna just cheer you up a little bit because we're gonna read the first ever graphic novel to win the Pulitzer, and that is Mouse by Art Spiegelman. Published.
Oh, is that like about cartoon mice hanging out with,
yes,
cats, right?
Cartoon mice hanging out with like a little Tom and Jerry sort of cartoon. I don't know why people are trying to ban it. Anyway, as we all know, Mouse is about the Holocaust, and it's basically Spiegelman interviewing his dad about his experiences as a Polish Jew during the Holocaust. And through the 80s and 90s, Spiegelman turned that into a comic that was originally published in the comics journal Raw. And we're going to read Mouse 1 and Mouse 2. So the entire shebang.
The Mouse Cinematic Universe?
The Mouse Cinematic Universe. I'm sure it's going to be a cheerful one, but an important one. I think Mouse has been... It's like... goes on and off the ban list. And I think it's back on it for some stupid reason. So fuck them. We're going to read it.
I'm just looking at our spreadsheet of everything we're doing in this A to Z thing. It's pretty dark. I mean, there's a little humor coming up, but like, this is, I don't think we've read a really happy book for a while, right?
I don't think, maybe we'll try to read a happy one at some point.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Be sure to share with a friend, subscribe, and leave us a review wherever you get your favorite podcasts. See lots of pretty pictures of the books we read at qtdcomics.com. And since we're sure no one's listening, prove us otherwise. Shoot an email over to say what I got right and what Ryan got wrong. qtdcomics@gmail.com. Give you a social media handle, but we're old, and that feels like too much work. I'm Roman Segal.
And I am and have always been Ryan Joe.
Yourself off, yeah. It's only in your head you feel left out or looked down on. Just try your best, try everything you can. It doesn't matter what they tell themselves when you're away. It just takes some time, little girl. You're in the Everything will be just fine. Everything will be alright. It just takes some time, little girl. You're in the middle of the ride. everything will be just fine. Everything will be alright. Hey, you know they're all the same. You know you do it better on your own, so don't buy it. Gotta live right now, just be yourself. It doesn't matter if that's good enough for someone else. It just takes some time, it'll throw you in the middle of the ride. Everything will be just fine. Everything will be alright, alright. It just takes some time, little girl, you're in the middle of the ride. Everything will be just fine. Everything will be alright, alright. Ooh, alright. Yourself off yet. It's only in your head you feel left out or looked down on. Just do your best, do everything you can. Don't worry about their bitter hearts are gonna say. Just fine. Everything will be alright. Ooh, everything is gonna be alright.
Holy
potluck.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.